Hi, my name is Dan Pollock. I work for America Online, AOL. This is about a simple object storage system that we built to enable web applications. The motivation for this system is that in the past, a bunch of web content was shared from a bunch of NAS filers, and the content is primarily static and tends to be distributed amongst a number of different web properties. So the idea is that traditional NAS system is the way this was originally used, and it tends to be somewhat costly, and the availability tends to be somewhat less than ideal. So the point there is that we wanted something better. And then one of the other things that would need to happen is that every time somebody would build an application for the web, they would not only need to build their application, but they would need to build a method for storing data within that application, even if it was using one of the systems like NAS or some other local storage. So every time they would build an application, they would have to build that part too. And it turns out that the traditional NAS infrastructure that was sufficiently scaled out and for content distribution, and the application time to build these different content storage systems would be very costly and inefficient. So we thought that there must be something better. And we did a bunch of research, and this was about the 2006 time frame, and right about this time, the seminal Google paper on the Google file system showed up, and we took a look at that, and we took a look at all of these other things, and we found that there were some choices that we had to make, and there were some clustered file systems that were available at the time. There were some scalable NAS options becoming available, and there were some more traditional high-performance computing file systems for shared access and those kinds of things as well, parallel file systems. What we settled on was a clustered file system called iBrix. iBrix was attractive because it allowed for the scalability that we needed. It allowed people to use it as a file system. It had good reliability, and it had good scale. One of the problems that we found with rolling this out, one of the other things that was nice about it was that it had the ability to use commodity hardware, so it was very low cost for deployment. Some of the problems that we found primarily were related to the iBrix metadata. The iBrix metadata was poorly replicated, and also odd things would happen when parts of the metadata tree structure went away. The client customers were expecting what looked like a file system, because indeed iBrix is a file system. However, it's not exactly POSIX compliant when you're using it, and things can go missing. And when they do, you get a very odd result. So most applications would either need to be changed to accommodate the oddities within iBrix, or would just fail. And most of our developers didn't kind of get that, and they had the failure case more often than making the modifications case. And it turns out that things like when you scan a directory tree and part of it's missing, and therefore part of the files go missing, gives you very unpleasant application results. So at the end of the day, customer satisfaction wasn't what it needed to be for iBrix, so we abandoned that attempt and said, okay, let's try something else. And we figured out that an object store is probably the way to go here. And we looked at all the possible object stores that we could deploy, and it turns out there weren't very many around the 2007-2008 timeframe. It was still pretty immature as far as technologies outside of places that had built their own. So we decided that building our own would be the best choice as well. So it's purpose-built. We use the same commodity hardware. In fact, we reused the whole entire iBrix infrastructure to recreate create the object store. And we chose to use only open source off-the-shelf components. So the system consists entirely of Tomcat, Linux, Apache, and MySQL and Java. There's nothing proprietary in it except the code that we wrote to put all these pieces together. The other things we decided was that in order to enable developer adoption, we would make it very simple externally. It would do exactly what they wanted to do and nothing else, and therefore we would take on all the responsibility for managing the data, making it durable, making it available, and all the developers had to do was know how to put files in and take files out. So it has a very simple external API. And one of the other things we did was prioritize manageability, because we knew that because we were taking on the responsibility for all of the data protection and data quality and data availability, that would need to be manageable in sort of internal to the system, And we wouldn't expose any of that to the external consumers because they don't really know and they don't really care and they don't want to have to. So the idea here is we manage all that internally and all they have to do is retrieve files or store files, and it's the same for every application that uses it, and that's a really interesting way to go about that. So here are most of the requirements. We wanted to have shared nothing in the components. The idea there is that we don't want to have any coupling between the different parts of the system so that it's more resilient that way. We wanted scalable metadata because one of the things that we found was that metadata scale is where the system ultimately scales to. So we wanted to make sure that we had a lot of capacity to scale metadata so that we could have very high throughput. We also opted for separate data and metadata components, and the reason for this was the Ibrix experience, where we found that when we put those two things together, while it's an interesting thing to do and it does sort of use the resources from one and the resources from the other so you don't have lower utilization when you're sort of unbalanced in metadata versus data, it turns out that they really have nothing to do with each other. And when you put one system in with the other system, you create some coupling there that is unnecessary and sometimes detrimental. We also allow for asymmetric components. There's nothing hardware aware in the system other than the physical monitoring that we build in. So the idea that you can add any new part to the system and it can be different in capabilities from any old part of the system was an important factor in our requirements. The system also has to be multi-site capable, and the reason for this is that every application should have a DR requirement. And for disaster recovery, we wanted to make sure that we weren't stuck in one site with all the files. So from day one, the system has been multi-site aware, and it's a logical configuration within the system that allows you to distribute files across multiple sites automatically, so the end user, once again, doesn't have to do anything to make sure that he's got disaster recovery because his data is in two sites or more at once. And like I said, the RESTful external API is very simple. It only does three things. There are actually a couple more things it does, but for the most part, you just get to do post to put file in, get to take a file out, and delete files if you're done with them, if you want to clean up. There are a couple other things that it can do, but for the most part, that's it. We also needed to make the system multi-tenant. We didn't want to have to build a separate object store for every application that would use it, even if they were all using the same API. We didn't want them to have to use their own bucket for this, and that way we would get economies of scale as we put more files in and just grow the system up. So it needed to be very slanted toward the multi-tenant environment, and the idea is that we would have multiple applications using it concurrently without any problems. So then one of the other things that we really did require was strong data protection. The idea is that we want people to be comfortable using the system and to make sure that their files will always be available, they'll always be there, and they'll always be correct. So we implemented a bunch of features of the system that are built around this idea of strong data protection, including background scrubbing and checking on access as well. We have also sort of offloaded some things that we didn't need from the system to external entities. One of them is security. We have access control internally for IP address, but more fine-grained security than that is expected to be handled by applications. Since most of the applications are consuming this the object store as opposed to individual users, we felt that it was okay to have the applications enforce security any more granular than just the access to the files themselves. So if you wanted individual file security versus just access to all the files within an application, the consuming application is expected to enforce that. We also add some extended object metadata so that if you have the idea that you want to store some data with your files about those files, we can do that. At this point, we don't do anything with that data, although that's a future feature enhancement. But the idea is that if you retrieve a file that you stored some metadata with, that you'll get that metadata back as well, so you can do whatever you would like with it within the application. We also made the system modular so that things that didn't need to be sort of fixed in configuration could be changed at any time. One good example of this is the metadata store, which can run in three different variants. We've used stock MySQL, we've used Clustrix, which is a scalable MySQL wire-compatible appliance, and we've also used VoltDB. So the modularity of the system is fairly good in that you can plug in different metadata components and also different storage node components and still get a same good performance result And you can experiment with changes in a controlled environment to see what changes make the system better and which ones make it worse. We also have external and internal hardware monitoring. So the idea is the system doesn't monitor itself a great deal. Most of the monitoring is handled by external systems that check the internals and do things that are whatever's appropriate as far as events are concerned. So the idea there is that we didn't want to build a lot of management and monitoring within the system if we had already existing external systems and external entities that were responsible for those systems. So we integrate with a time series data store that we already have for metrics and performance, collection and graphing. We integrate with Nagios and with our NOC and their ticketing system for failure and events of interest. So here's the implementation, just in sort of over-level architectural diagram. Clients will make requests of a load balancer. The load balancer will send requests to the storage nodes, be it a put or a get or a file write or a file read. The storage nodes will do the appropriate database lookup based on what that request type is. If it's a file request, they'll look up the file object ID in the database and then find out where it is and return it. Or if it's a file post, file write, they'll write the file locally, update the database, write another copy to an appropriate system, generally within the same rack but off the system itself so that there's no data loss potential. They'll acknowledge the return back to the client and then they'll schedule a third copy. We support replica databases for different functions. While the read-write database can be very busy doing updates, it may be of interest to scale read performance. So the idea there is that we can support read-only replicas of the database and provide much better metadata read performance if that's required by simply adding more more replicas for read capability. We also have a replica of the database for doing admin jobs, and the reason for that is that you don't want the admin jobs and their performance requirements to constrain the system experience for the end user customers. So the idea is there you run admin jobs against the admin replica, which is a replicated copy of the production read-write replica, and therefore anything like file background scanning and all those things can be handled by the admin database, and any jobs that need to be scheduled within the database can be then forwarded back to the read-write with just the changes that need to be made, but none of the query load is experienced by the read-write copy of the database. So, like I said, this is the write example. You post a request from the client, the load balancer selects a server, writes the file, updates the database, writes another file, updates the database, et cetera, et cetera. I talked about this. So then there's the read example. And reads are a little bit more interesting. Same thing happens. You request from the VIP a read. The read request goes to any server. If the server has the file in its local cache, and one of the things that happens is that we cache files that are retrieved frequently. That way, we don't have to do a referred request or a proxied request for files that we retrieve a lot. We do have the option to do both of those things based on file size. So we can retrieve a file locally if it exists locally. If it doesn't exist locally, when we look it up in the database, we can proxy it on the behalf of the owning server, one of the owning servers, or we can refer the original client, and that's based on file size. And that the idea there is that larger files you would want to sort of refer and smaller files you would just want to proxy because it would be less time. So that's the idea. And then one of the other things, like I said, is that if you retrieve files often enough, they wind up in the cache. And then they're all served locally from every node, and that gives us a lot of access scalability for files that are very frequently retrieved. So if you miss the cache, you go look at the database. The database gives you a copy or the locations of all the copies of the replicas. You pick one, and you do the appropriate thing based on the file size, either serve it locally, proxy it, or refer it. One other interesting thing happens when you do a lookup against the database. If you get a 404 when you get a read and you're running read-only and read-write replicas, it's possible that the file is just not there, and that's okay. Somebody's retrieving a file that doesn't exist, or they fat-fingered it, or what have you. But the idea there is that if it's 404 and it's replication lag that's causing the problem because you looked at the read-only copy of the database and not the read-write copy of the database, then when a 404 occurs at the client, we can tell the application, and this is application-based as well, go look at the read-write copy of the database just to make sure that the file is not indeed there. And then if it's not really there, serve the 404, somebody deleted it, doesn't exist, a hacking attempt. We get a lot of those. And that's kind of the idea. So that covers you for replication lag. And the only issue there is how far apart the server and the database are. And in general, that hasn't been a problem yet. So then the idea is there are a couple other failures. The database is unavailable. It's a really bad day. You get a 502 on writes, and that's terrible. We try and avoid that at all costs, and so far we have. Write failure in the initial file cause a 500 error. Any number of reasons for that can occur, can be possible. The idea there is that we do the right thing and send you, we failed to store this file, please try again. And most applications do something with the 500 appropriately, either try again or send an alarm or something, so that's helpful, if not what they really wanted to do. And then one of the other things that we manage is if we fail the second replica creation, we just retry that, and we can keep retrying that. I think the threshold is configurable, and now I think it's 6 or 8 times that we try and store the second copy of the file before we acknowledge the write to the client. Even if we fail the second copy and the first copy is written, we'll acknowledge the write as okay, I believe, and then we'll go ahead and set the replication flag in the database, and we'll create replicas up to the number that's required anyway. But at least we try and make the 2 synchronous copies before we tell you that your file is safe, because it might not be. So then when a retrieved file is corrupt or unavailable, because we deliver all the replica locations, and if you select a replica location that the file has gone missing for some reason, like the server crashed and we recreated the file system or something like that, then what happens is there's a background job that'll find these files that are missing and re-replicate them to whatever the requirement is. Additionally, if you retrieve them before we get around to it in the background, and a replication job will immediately be scheduled for that file so that the one that went missing will get recreated and you'll get one of the other copies that's still good so that your application can continue. We have some other interesting features in the system itself. We have automatic file expiration, and that's configurable by application. This turns out to be really nifty for short-term duration file sharing. We have a product called AIM that allows our users to do this. So if you upload, if you get a picture of a new car and you want to send it to your family, you can do that sort of immediately, and then the file doesn't hang around very long. It's just something you say, here, look, I want you to see this, and then our application takes care of it vanishing, and people know about that. So that's kind of a nifty way to manage files and get rid of them when you don't really need them, because a lot of files just kind of pile up, and we have 2 years of files, or 3 years probably, in the system now, and very few of them are actually in use, probably less than 5%, I think. One of the other things that we allow, although we discourage, is people setting their own object IDs. And the idea here is that you can set a prefix with your application name and then set your own object ID. And this is of use to applications where the object ID may contain some metadata that actually maps to the real file metadata itself. Things like map geo-coordinates. You can specify the MapQuest for AOL's map property. You can specify MapQuest as the prefix, and then the GPS coordinates, the actual tile location that you would put the map in, and then you don't actually have to save the object ID. You can retrieve them directly. There are some other folks who might want to do this, things like Winamp. They may want to store song names with the MP3s that they store in the future, if that makes sense to them, and then they don't have to look up, you know, who owns the song and the song name. It's just part of the file name, the object ID. So that's kind of an interesting feature and a useful one to some of our customers. Most of them use the object IDs we generate because they manage the content through an external CMS anyway. Like I said, frequently accessed files that are cached, and we also have some rudimentary usage accounting, and we're working on improving that as well. So the idea there is that you'll be able to tell which files belong to which applications, and you can theoretically either send them bills or at least just note awareness of what their utilization of the system is. These are some statistics. A few hundred million objects, 400 million in the system. We've seen over 200 million requests in a single day without any real issue. The high water mark is about that. The current The current system itself is between 60 and 80 million requests a day. Most requests are take less than 100 milliseconds. Almost all requests take less than 500 milliseconds. And that statistic I gotta take with a grain of salt because it doesn't take into account file sizes. So obviously, and also which ones are coming out of the cache versus which ones aren't retrieved out of the cache. Once again, the high water mark for data pushed is about 165 terabytes, and then there are 40-odd file or systems. I'll kind of ignore the enhancements for now and see if I can get the demo to work. And then if there's time, we'll look at questions. Okay. All right, so this is what it looks like if you just hit the URL natively. Nobody can do this except the internal VPN that I'm using. But the idea here is that you can pick a file. You can also you do this by, oh look, there's my paper. You can do this by programmatically, which is what most people do. Nobody does this this way. We just do this kind of for testing and for demos because we think it might be neat. Anyway, while that's uploading, I assume it's uploading. Here's the admin GUI. It kind of enumerates the hosts and disks. And I think a bunch of this is in the paper as well. All of these things can be sort of modified. You can take entire nodes online or offline. You can take individual disks and change their state. And when those state changes happen, you can cause files to move on and off the disks and hosts. In addition, you can add drives. There are some global configs that may or may not ever load. So here's the file. Here's the URL to the file and the object ID that we got back. Most people just take that object ID and store it in their CMS or do whatever it is they need to do with it. When you append the debug request at the end, it'll tell you where those files wound up. So you can see that we wound up on three different servers and in two different racks and on a bunch of different disks in the system. And if we retrieve them, go back and do that while we're waiting. Yep, we can open the copy. And it looks just like, oop, not good. It looks just like my paper. And so go back, and the other three copies are the same. I'll kind of stipulate that for now. And then the idea there is that you can delete that file. One of the other things that you see here is the site. In this case, because this is a load cluster for people to do bring up and development work, we only have one site. But in the actual production versions of this, we have multiple sites, and they can store files via distribution, so you can tell it you want to store the original two copies in the writing in wherever the site was that the write occurred. And then the third copy or however many additional replicas for durability can be distributed throughout the site. So in general, we each store three copies of the data. The first two are written locally to two separate servers and two separate racks, and the third copy is written to the remote site. So even if you have an entire site failure, that file will still live on. And then you can re-replicate it based on if the number of copies that disappeared were two or one. You just kind of schedule the appropriate replication jobs, and you're protected across sites as well. So far, latency hasn't been a problem. Our sites are sort of metro configured. We're going to attempt to make that a little bit broader in the near future. So anyway, I deleted this file, and so here's what happens when the file goes away, and that's what's supposed to happen. So that's pretty much the demo. Like I said, this is the admin GUI. You can change all of these kind of parameters, and I think they're in the paper. Here's the application list, maybe. Sure, there's the application list. And this is a list of folks doing some development work, and you can see what's configured by default for the applications, like expire time and whether or not the files get expired, even if you have expire time set. That's what I get for using virtual desktops. And some of the other interesting things, like use cache. So that's the demo. And here's an example of our dashboard, and I guess I got time for maybe like 2 minutes of questions. A little more than 2 minutes of questions. Sweet, so I think I did okay.
When you guys were looking at this, did you guys say anything about MobileFS?
So the question is, do we look at MobileFS? We looked at a lot of different options, and Mogul's one that comes up a lot. The idea there is that we felt that there was too much built into those kinds of things, just like there's too much built into a lot of the clustered file systems and a lot of the sort of object stores that are coming up now, things like Ceph and that kind of, and those sorts of things. So the idea there was that we'd build it just much simpler and layer those features on as time went on. So yeah, I mean, we did, like I said, exhaustive research on all the possibilities, and we even tried Ibrix as an option. Right, so the idea is that the design characteristics are stolen completely from other people's work, right? So this is not in any way a novel approach. The idea here is that it's just much simpler and has a lot fewer moving parts, and it's all built of off-the-shelf open source components, so everybody can get Apache, Tomcat, MySQL, and one of the things that we're contemplating is open sourcing it, and then you can get our code as well and recreate this. And the idea isn't that you would make this a product. The idea is that a lot of people are looking for object stores to enable this sort of functionality in their business, and they don't want to pay Amazon, right? Netflix can. Their pricing works out. Not everybody else's does, and the idea here is that you can build your own from a very small set of components, right? Our clusters are almost all fewer than 100 servers, but this works great, and it turns out that you can get an enormous amount of data into that something that size, and it's not incredibly expensive. Whereas I think for what we pay, just the run rate for our entire 4 years would be less than 6 months of what Amazon would cost at our scale, and that's compelling enough for our business to not want to do the Amazon thing and want to sort of fund this a little bit. So all of this, I should say, everything that all the web properties that use it are generally fronted by a CDN in origin mode. There are some files that don't make sense for CDN and caching, but for the most part, if it's the origin server mode that most people use it in because it's for mostly publishing that sort of data, then yeah, it's all CDN at a higher level. And there's, if you look at the config GUI, there's a require CDN option, and that'll flow into the CDN, and it adjusts the expire times and does some other interesting things that make it work well with CDN. Is that a question?
How do you deal with the case where a storage server is down while an object is modified, and then it comes back up with divergent data?
So the question is, how do we deal with the case where an object is modified while one of the hosting storage servers is down, and then it comes back up with the wrong version of the object? In general, we don't allow modification of the objects, and that's the way we get around that. So if you want to store the same file twice, you get two unique object IDs, and you cannot modify data. There's an option to the system that allows for file update, and that's given us a little bit of complication with the sort of fits and starts over that specific problem. We've noticed that if file's offline or if a server's offline while you try and do an update, the update fails. We're working on that sort of as we go here, but that's a relatively recent bug we discovered, and because very few people use it in that mode, they don't do updates for the most part. They're more okay with just storing another version of the object and throwing the old one away. So that's something we do need to sort of improve.
That's actually kind of all the time we have. So let's thank Dan for this.
Thanks a lot.